shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
God, I hate the Germans. The maggot General Dwight David Eisenhower wrote to his wife Mamie in September of 1944. Earlier, in front of the British ambassador to Washington, he had said that all the 3,500 or so officers of the German general staff should be exterminated. Eisenhower was, by his own statements, a self-hating ethnic German. Could that have accounted for his inhuman treatment of German prisoners following the collapse of the Third Reich and the unconditional surrender of Germany? Ike became Supreme Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Forces in 1943, and as such was ultimately responsible for the actions of all Allied, except Soviet, troops in the European theater. The Jews threw a rose-scented blanket over Ike's actions as Supreme Commander, including the charge that more than 1 million German POWs were systematically starved to death on Ike's orders. Despite the whitewash of Eisenhower's war record, his attitude toward Germans and Germany was not unknown, just not discussed in establishment circles. It was Eisenhower, after all, who gave the orders that halted advancing American troops and allowed the Soviets to occupy Berlin and half of Germany. When it was suggested to him that he was following orders, he explicitly denied that anyone but himself gave the order to allow the USSR to take half of Germany. That he could have been unaware of what the invading Soviets were doing to the prostrate German civilian population is impossible. On September 20th, 1945, Eisenhower, along with British Field Marshal Bernard Law Montgomery, and Soviet generals L. Lutz and V. D. Sokolovsky, signed Allied Proclamation No. 2, Section 6 of the proclamation orders the German government to supply the Allies with German civilian labor as part of the war reparations to be used inside and outside Germany. Back in 1956, Texas State Senator Dudley T. Daugherty had this to say about Proclamation No. 2, quote, "As a result of this slave labor proclamation, which carried out part of the iniquitous Yalta terms, over 300,000 civilian German men were taken by force and shipped into the USSR as slave laborers. The vast majority of those Germans died from physical exhaustion and disease. 11 German generals were hanged following the Nuremberg German War Crimes Trials in 1946. Part of the indictments against them stated that during the war, they were guilty of the crime of taking civilian slave laborers to work for the German armies. General Eisenhower committed the same crime of civilian slave labor when he signed the Allied Proclamation No. 2 at Berlin, permitting slave labor to be considered a form of war reparations from Germany. The document was signed at the request of the Soviets to give them civilian slave labor. This was a dreadful crime, and as a result of Eisenhower's crime, many thousands of German slave laborers died in the Soviet Union. By our official admission, we had brought Germany down to a daily food level of from 700 to 1,500 calories, which was less than an American breakfast, and which led to sure gradual death. Some of our own senators declared this starvation to be planned and deliberate. In fact, so determined were our Jewish policymakers to starve the conquered that they callously prohibited even private charity. And these were German civilians. German POWs fared even worse. A search of the French military archives at Vincennes, a Paris suburb, turned up some contemporary descriptions by horrified French officers and civilian leaders. The most shocking, like Buchenwald, peopled with living skeletons, concerned a group of camps in West Germany that in late July of 1945 had just been turned over to the French. Before that, they had been run by the Americans. It was at the U.S. National Archives on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington that a file was found titled Headquarters, U.S. Forces, European Theater, G1 Division, which proved to be the United States Army's official weekly POW and DEF, that's Disarmed Enemy Forces, ledgers for a short period in the autumn of 1945. They laid out, by military district, the number of prisoners on hand at the start of the week, the number acquired or transferred, the number discharged, and, before giving the closing balance, the number in one other category, other losses. Roughly 5,000 POWs were lost in 1 week from one group of 700,000. Research turned up Eisenhower's initials on a cable dated March 10, 1945, proving he had probably drafted, certainly had full knowledge of, the proposal to redesignate German prisoners of war that were protected by the Geneva Convention as DEF, not protected. By late April of 1945, Eisenhower's quartermaster general at Supreme Headquarters, American Expeditionary Forces, SHAFE, General Robert Littlejohn, had already reduced rations to prisoners, and a SHAFE message signed Eisenhower had reported to General George Marshall, the United States Army Chief of Staff, that the prisoner pens would provide, quote, no shelter or other comforts, end quote. The problem was not supplies. The Army itself had so much food in reserve that when a whole warehouse full was dropped from the supply list by accident in England, it was not noticed for 3 months. In addition, the International Committee of the Red Cross had over 100,000 tons of food in storage in Switzerland. There were an abundance of captured German stores also. When it tried to send 2 trainloads of this to the American sector of Germany, U.S. Army officers turned the trains back, saying their warehouses were already overflowing with food, which they had never distributed. At the big Rhine Meadows concentration camps for German prisoners, opened by the Americans in mid-April, there were no tents, buildings, cooking facilities, water, latrines, or food. One former German POW, Wolfgang Eef, who still resides in Germany, reports that in his subsection of perhaps 10,000 prisoners, 30 to 40 bodies were dragged out every day. A member of the burial work party, Eef says he helped haul the dead from his cage out to the gate of the camp where the bodies were carried by wheelbarrow to several big steel garages. There Eef and his team stripped the corpses of clothing, snapped off half of each aluminum dog tag, spread the bodies in layers of 15 to 20, with 10 shovelfuls of quicklime over each layer till they were stacked more than a yard high. Placed the personal effects in a bag for the Americans, then left. Some of the corpses were dead of gangrene following frostbite. It was an unusually wet, cold spring. A dozen or more other prisoners had grown too weak to cling to the log flung across the ditch for a latrine and had fallen off and drowned in the human excrement. Almighty God, please forgive America for what we have done. The conditions in the American camps along the Rhine in late April were observed by two colonels in the United States Army Medical Corps, James Mason and Charles Beasley, who described them in a paper, quote, "Huddled close together for warmth, behind the barbed wire was a most awesome sight. Nearly 100,000 haggard, apathetic, dirty, gaunt, blank-staring men clad in dirty, field-gray uniforms and standing ankle-deep in mud. Please note the comparison between these, our Aryan brothers in Germany, and our own brave, heroic soldiers of the Confederacy in 1860. The Jews caused the Washington government during the Civil War to treat our southern Christian Aryan kin in the same way as we did the Germans in World War II. Also note that both armies wore the same field gray uniforms and were fighting against the Jewish interest money system, even though the wars were 100 years apart. Wake up, America." Continuing the quote from the soldiers Mason and Beasley, the German division commander reported that the men had not eaten for at least 2 days, and the provision of water was a major problem. Yet only 200 yards away was the River Rhine running bank full, end quote. German POWs in the United States were transferred to DEF status and immediately lost all the protections of the Geneva Convention. They lost mail privileges, food packages, and visits from the Red Cross. Back in Germany, General G.E.H. Lee reported that he had records of 1 million more men in the U.S. camps in Europe than Schaeff said it had on its books. The records were obviously being fudged by Schaeff so that the number of German POWs dying would not be reported. On August 4th, a one-sentence order signed Eisenhower condemned all prisoners of war still on hand in the United States camps to DEF status. Quote, "Effective immediately, all members of the German forces held in the United States custody in the American zone of occupation in Germany will be considered as disarmed enemy forces and not as having the status of prisoner of war," end quote. No reason was given. Surviving weekly tallies suggest the dual classification was preserved, but for the POWs now being treated as DEFs, the death rate quadrupled within a few weeks. During the 1950s, most non-record material relating to the U.S. prison camps was destroyed by the Army. It has been reliably reported that undoubtedly 800,000, almost certainly more than 900,000, and quite probably over 1 million Germans died in the French and American camps by order of the Jews. At least 10 times as many as were killed in all the combat on the Western Front in Northwest Europe from America's entry into the war in 1941 through April 1945. And to think this low-life, anti-Christ murderer, Eisenhower, became president of our United States. Few Americans are aware of Dwight Eisenhower's many associations with notorious international communist Jewish agents. For instance, little is heard about the infamous conference which Eisenhower held in his military headquarters in England with the communist traitor Harry Dexter White, or Weiss, as his real name was, W-E-I-S-S. This meeting was to discuss the implementation of mass murder known as the Morgenthau Plan, whose avowed purpose was to starve 20 million Germans to death to make Europe safe for the Soviet Union. Weiss was one of the three communist agents in America, the other two being Lachlan Curry and Alger Hiss, both personal assistants of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who launched Eisenhower on his career. The Eisenhower-Weiss conferences were revealed in the United Nations World of February 1947. Secretary of the Treasury from 1934 to 1945, the Jew Henry Morgenthau Jr. planned to turn Germany into an agricultural society, removing all industry from the country. The plan was first discussed at Potsdam. In 1947, Morgenthau wrote, "Germany is Our Problem," published by the Eleanor and Henry Morgenthau Jr. Foundation for Peace, Incorporated, said a jacket blurb, "Here is the Morgenthau Plan for Germany, now released for the first time in complete form. It differs in important respects from the interim plan announced from Potsdam and is of particular importance now when the long-term policies for Germany must be determined." Eisenhower in London was surrounded by partners of the Jewish Kuhn Loeb Company and other top communist propagandists. His chief of information, the Jew James Paul Warburg of Kuhn Loeb, who, quote, "followed the communist line for many years," unquote, his special advisor on political affairs was Captain E. M. Warburg of Kuhn Loeb. His naval attaché was John Schiff of Kuhn Loeb, grandson of the Jew backer of the communist revolution in Tsarist Russia. Corruption, intrigue, and political treachery made possible Dwight D. Eisenhower's victory at the Republican presidential nomination convention in Chicago in 1952. The story of Eisenhower's triumph over Republican frontrunner to Senator Robert A. Taft of Ohio is little known among the general public. But within informed political circles, the full truth about the Eisenhower campaign is ranked as a textbook example of Jew power politics at its most insidious. Had it not been for the organized support of virtually every Jewish establishment pressure group, utilizing every means possible, including bribery, blackmail, and character defamation, there is simply no way Eisenhower could have overwhelmed the grassroots support for the Ohio senator who was revered far and wide among GOP voters as Mr. Republican. To understand fully the circumstances which led to Eisenhower's nomination in 1952, it is necessary to review Taft's own political background and the events in the preceding years that made Taft's vanquishing a must for the international Jewish establishment. Taft was born the same year that Adolf Hitler was. On September 8, 1889, in Cincinnati, the son of William Howard Taft, who later served as 27th president and as Chief Justice of the United States. A graduate of Yale University and Harvard Law School, the younger Taft was elected to the Senate in 1938. Quickly establishing himself as an up-and-coming leader in Republican ranks. He was perhaps the most respected and articulate critic of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's domestic New Deal. Taft is most remembered, however, for his dedicated but unsuccessful efforts to prevent America from being dragged into World War II. Taft's liberal internationalist critics called him an isolationist. Taft responded by saying, "If isolation means isolation from a European war, I am an isolationist." Just 2 years after his election to the Senate, Taft was already being prodded to run for president by the nationalist forces which then predominated within the Republican Party. Taft's supporters rejected the theory that American intervention in Britain's war was necessary to preserve America's sovereignty and independence. Taft's supporters, like the Ohio statesman, placed America's interests first. Of the pro-war forces within Republican ranks, Taft wrote, "The most conservative members of the party, the Wall Street bankers, the Society Group, 9/10 of the pro-democratic newspapers, and most of the party's financial contributors are the ones who favor intervention in Europe. I have received thousands of letters on both sides of the question," Taft noted, "and I should say without question that it is the average man and woman, the farmer, the workman, and the small businessman who are opposed to war. The war party is made up of business community of the cities, the newspaper and magazine writers, the radio and movie commentators, the communists, and the university intelligentsia." The Jew establishment recognized, much to its dismay, that Taft was clearly the front runner for the Republican presidential nomination in 1940, and in its own fashion, hoped to reach some sort of accord with the popular Republican. And after all, there was the distinct possibility that the Jog's number one choice, incumbent President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, then seeking an unprecedented and highly controversial third term, could be defeated for re-election. Therefore, it was imperative that the Republican victor, whoever it might be, share the Jews' desire for American intervention in the British war in Europe. Taft was moving forward toward the GOP nomination with little opposition, but the Jews were willing to give the Ohio Senator the benefit of the doubt, willing to give him one last chance to prove his fealty to the powers that be. Shortly before the opening of the GOP nomination convention, Taft was invited to a dinner party at the home of Ogden Reed, liberal Republican publisher of the New York Herald Tribune, now defunct, then a powerful voice for the internationalist Jewish foreign policy aims that Taft opposed. Taft and his wife Martha were bombarded for hours on end with the pro-war ravings of Lord Lyttelton, the British ambassador to the United States, Thomas Lamont, the chairman of the J.P. Morgan Company, Dorothy Thompson, a virulently anti-German columnist for the New York Times, and Wendell L. Willkie, a Midwestern utilities executive who had made it big on Wall Street. Willkie, a longtime Democrat, was the establishment's dark horse choice to challenge Taft for the Republican nomination. In fact, a well-funded nationwide network of Willkie boosters was already being set in place. After listening quietly to the anti-peace harangues of those gathered, Taft interrupted. "I had not intended to take any part in this discussion," he said, "but I feel that I cannot sit here and let my silence be interpreted as agreement." End of quote. Taft then proceeded to explain, calmly and logically, his own reasons for opposing American involvement in Britain's latest European continental imbroglio. The Ohio senator was angrily shouted down. Those present remembered with distaste for many years the rancorous and emotional bickering that raged for the rest of that fateful evening. And according to British writer Henry Fairley, it would not be too much to say that by his interruption at that dinner, Taft forfeited the support of the Eastern establishment for the rest of his career. End quote. Shortly afterward, Ogden Reed's Herald Tribune endorsed Willkie for the GOP nod, as did other Jewish-controlled journals. Following the Herald Tribune's lead, and the Wilkie boom was formally launched. It was at the controversial Republican convention in Philadelphia that the full impact of the Jewish establishment's covert activities on behalf of the Wilkie campaign came to the fore. Wilkie's victory was far from ensured. Taft's forces were still hard at work, and the nomination was up for grabs. But set in place was a cleverly coordinated operation designed to undercut the grassroots support that had built up behind Taft. Well-paid, pro-Wilkie agitators crammed the gallery's roaring, spontaneous chants of "We want Wilkie" each time the presidential contender's name was mentioned from the podium, making it appear as though Wilkie had far more supporters than he really did. Many pro-Taft and uncommitted delegates were bribed, sometimes blackmailed, into lining up behind Wilkie. The funds behind these efforts seemed unlimited. Consequently, Taft's candidacy collapsed under the pressure of the fraudulent Wilkie bandwagon. Wilkie won the nomination and went into the general election mimicking the pro-British line of his Democratic opponent, President Roosevelt. FDR won an easy victory. Comfortably enthroned in the White House for a third term, he led America into war. Taft opted not to seek the Republican nomination in 1944. FDR's fourth term was a distasteful inevitability. The Ohio senator concentrated on his Senate re-election campaign, keeping his option open for a second bid for the White House in 1948. It was in the 1948 campaign that Eisenhower was first seriously mentioned as a presidential contender, not as a Republican, however, but as a Democrat. Indeed, when revulsion toward Truman within Democratic ranks was at its height prior to Truman's nomination victory at the party's national convention, many leading liberals were actively encouraging the retired Army general to challenge Truman for the Democratic nod. Among them included two of the late President Roosevelt's sons, Franklin Jr. and Elliot. Also, Phil Murray and Kerry of the left-wing CIO Labor Trust, the leaders of the hard-line Liberal Party of New York, and the very liberal Americans for Democratic Action, among many others. Eisenhower rebuffed the efforts on his behalf. He was waiting, probably told to wait, until 1952. That year, Eisenhower would emerge as the Jews' candidate to stop Taft. Interestingly, it was one Leonard Finder who bragged that he was the first person to call publicly for Eisenhower to run for the presidency on the Republican ticket in 1952 as a stop Taft candidate. Finder, one of the founders of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, an illegally registered lobby for the government of Israel, even went so far as to change his party registration and become an instant Republican in order to add legitimacy to his support for Eisenhower. After Eisenhower formally launched his 1952 presidential campaign, Taft remarked pointedly about the forces that had aligned behind his opponent. Quote, "The main Eisenhower men seemed to be the international bankers, the Dewey Organization allied with them, the Republican New Dealers, and even President Truman. Apparently, they wished to be sure that no matter which party wins, they win." End of quote. Eisenhower's loyalty to the Republican Party was under question. No one seemed to know where he stood on the issues, except that according to populist Republican Representative B. Carroll Reese of Tennessee, quote, "It looks like Eisenhower is pretty much for mother home and heaven," end quote. But Eisenhower had the controlled media of the Jewish establishment behind him, and his campaign began to pick up steam. Although by the time of the Republican National Convention in Chicago, Taft had received substantially more popular votes in the primaries than Eisenhower, the retired general's candidacy was a force to be reckoned with, for the media's smear campaign against Taft's organization began to unravel the Ohio lawmakers' base of support. However, it was the Dewey-coordinated Eisenhower machine that was bribing delegates, using high-pressure tactics, blackmail and extortion against the Taft forces. It was the credentials fight on the floor of the convention that gave the Jews the opportunity to turn loose a barrage of anti-Taft propaganda, which many believe turned the tide in Eisenhower's favor. In three southern states, Georgia, Louisiana, and Texas, Taft and Eisenhower delegates were vying for the right to be seated at the Republican convention. The Taft delegates were from the grassroots of the GOP, elected under the regular Republican and Texas state rules. Not so with the Eisenhower delegates. They had been elected by thousands of liberal Democrats who had been persuaded to pour into Republican polling booths in Texas in order to vote for Eisenhower, this being the work of Eisenhower's Jewish handlers. However, it still took approval by the full Republican convention before the illegal Eisenhower delegates would be seated. The media promptly took up the cry, tarring Taft as a thief, although clearly it was the Eisenhower forces who were the real thieves. And at the convention, the maneuvering by the Eisenhower backers constituted politicking of the worst sort. The large California contingents supported seating the Eisenhower delegates after then Golden State Governor Earl Warren, a very liberal Republican, and Dewey's running mate in 1948, was promised a Supreme Court appointment. And then Senator Richard M. Nixon of California was offered the vice presidential nomination if Eisenhower won the top spot on the GOP ticket. The deal went through, and both promises were fulfilled. Warren was made Chief Justice of the United States by Eisenhower, ushering in an outrageous era of judicial activism that crippled our Constitution, leaving it little more than a shell of the document conceived by our founding fathers. Nixon, of course, went on ultimately to the presidency, leaving behind a legacy of political scandal and intrigue reminiscent of the far lesser known seamy circumstances that brought Nixon onto the Republican ticket in 1952 to begin with. With the support of the, quote, bought, unquote, California delegates, the disputed Eisenhower delegates were seated, and Taft's campaign came to a halt. Eisenhower won the nomination, but Taft was far from pleased with the results. Shortly after the 1952 convention, Taft was asked what caused his loss to Eisenhower. First, said Taft, quote, it was the power of the New York financial interests and a large number of businessmen subject to New York influence who selected General Eisenhower as their candidate at least a year ago. Secondly, he added, four-fifths of the influential newspapers of the country were opposed to me continuously and vociferously, and many turned themselves into propaganda sheets for Eisenhower. He later remarked that, since 1936, every Republican candidate for president was selected by the Chase Manhattan Bank, the flagship of the global corporate empire of the Rockefeller family. But Taft was not a bitter man. As a loyal American and loyal Republican, he did all he could to continue helping advance the interests of both his nation and his party in that order. Taft was an effective congressional force for nationalist principles. Taft was suddenly stricken with cancer shortly after Eisenhower was sworn into office, and ultimately died on July 31, 1953, shortly before his 64th birthday. According to the late Dr. Wesley Swift, Taft's cancer was caused by the Jews having a radioactive substance embedded in his chair. Although Taft never reached the presidency as did his father, he remains a respected figure in American history. As Jesus said in the 8th chapter of John, the Jews are Satan's children, and Satan was a murderer and the father of the lie. Here's something interesting for you. From the United States Army Military History Research Collection, Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, from the Omar Bradley Museum. It's a page out of the West Point Yearbook. and will probably show you why Eisenhower was promoted over the heads of more than 30 other more experienced and senior U.S. officers for the post of Allied Commander in 43. It says Dwight David Eisenhower, Abilene, Kansas, senatorial appointee, Kansas. It reads, "This is Senior Dwight David Eisenhower, gentlemen, the terrible Swedish Jew, as big as life and twice as natural. The day General Patton puked." After World War II, General George S. Patton described Jews living under his military authority in southern Germany. For September 17, 1945, 5 months after the liberation of the last of the German concentration camps, Patton wrote, quote, "We drove for about 45 minutes to a Jewish camp, established in what had been a German hospital. The buildings were therefore in a good state of repair when the Jews arrived, but were in a bad state of repair when we arrived, because these Jewish DPs, or at least a majority of them, have no sense of human relationships. They decline, where practicable, to use latrines, preferring to relieve themselves on the floor. This happened to be the feast of Yom Kippur, so they were all collected in a large wooden building which they called a synagogue. It behooved General Eisenhower to make a speech to them. We entered the synagogue, which was packed with the greatest stinking bunch of humanity I have ever seen. When we got about halfway up, the head rabbi, who was dressed in a fur hat similar to that worn by Henry VIII of England, and in a surplice heavily embroidered and very filthy, came down and met the general. However, the smell was so terrible that I almost fainted, and actually, about 3 hours later, lost my lunch as a result of remembering it." End of quote. One of the most widespread myths about the bombing campaigns of the Second World War is that the Germans started the bombing of cities. In fact, it was the Royal Air Force which deliberately started this form of aerial warfare, and the Luftwaffe's blitzkrieg was only their reply to it. In discussing the bombing of cities, one must leave aside the bombardment of cities, which is totally different. A city is bombarded either from the air or by artillery, in support of approaching troops, whereas a place is bombed for no other reason than to destroy as many buildings and kill as many people as possible. The Nazis were put on trial for allegedly deliberately killing Jewish civilians, yet the British were not put on trial for deliberately murdering German civilians during aerial bombing raids on civilian targets, such as Dresden. During the war, approximately 3 million German civilians were killed by Allied bombing. In Britain, an estimated 60,000 civilians were killed by German bombing. 61 German cities, with a total population of 25 million, were totally destroyed. In Britain, large-scale devastation was limited to the central parts of London, Coventry, and Plymouth. The British decision to provoke these tit-for-tat murders, described by military expert and historian Captain B.H. Liddell Hart as, quote, "the most uncivilized method of warfare the world has known since the Mongol invasions," end quote, was taken in secret. Mr. J.M. Speight, a former principal secretary at the Air Ministry, writes, "Because we were doubtful about the psychological effect of propagandist distortion of the truth, that it was we who started the strategic bombing offensive, we have shrunk from giving our great decision of May 11, 1940, the publicity it deserved. That surely was a mistake. It was a splendid decision. End of quote. That night, 18 Whitley bombers attacked railway stations in western Germany. On the 15th, 99 planes were dispatched to bomb the Ruhr. More raids were made against Hamburg, Bremen, the Ruhr area again, and Frankfurt. In June, Bomber Command was preparing to use a special incendiary pellet to burn German crops and forests. Throughout June, the Germans refrained from responding in like manner. Finally, they reacted to stop the raids by bombing British airfields to prevent the RAF taking off. But to Churchill, the moving force behind the new policy, this was not enough. The Germans must be provoked into bombing cities so that the British people would really hate the enemy, who, up until then, had appeared rather humane in their actions. On August 25th, 81 bombers were dispatched in the first of a series of night raids on Berlin. It was not until the 7th of September, 3 months after the first British attack, that the Luftwaffe replied in kind with an attack on London. A few weeks later, the Germans took the initiative and proposed a bombing truce, although the Luftwaffe still had an enormous advantage in bombing strength. But the British wanted no such truce. Heavier bombers for the RAF were already under production in the United States, and the blitz against Germany was stepped up. The German raids against Britain dwindled in the spring of 1941 and all but ceased as the Luftwaffe was shifted towards the Eastern Front. The Germans were more interested in fighting and destroying communism than massacring British civilians. In September 1943, bomber captains were told to attack any target in a built-up area if they could not find the target specified. When Mannheim was attacked in December 1943, the orders were to concentrate on the center of the town. Prime Minister Winston Churchill was a strong proponent of bombing people as people. In July 1941, according to the RAF official historians, he was an enthusiast for the mass bombardment of German towns, and in August repeatedly urged it. In January 1941, when oil installations were named as the principal target, he regretted that oil plants were for the most part removed from the centers of population. By the summer of 1941, British bombing was, in effect, indiscriminate. Only one-third of all aircraft were recorded as having dropped their bombs within 5 miles of their target. This was illustrated on the 1st of October 1941, when, with the specified objectives being Karlsruhe and Stuttgart, planes of the Bomber Command were reported over 27 other German cities. In July, bombers were ordered to make heavy, concentrated, and continuous area attacks on large working-class and industrial areas. Sir Archibald Sinclair, the Minister for Air, expressed himself as being in complete agreement with another MP who had urged the bombing of working-class areas, slaying in the name of the Lord. Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden suggested attacking mainly lightly defended towns under 150,000 population in order to produce greater psychological effects. Bomber Command rose to its new vocation, mass extermination from the sky, with a series of giant attacks using new incendiary techniques. The ancient and historic city of Lübeck was chosen. Although it was a relatively unimportant place, it was one of the most inflammable parts of Germany, wrote the official RAF historians. A large area of the city was burnt to the ground on the night of 28th of March, including the cathedral and numerous other historic buildings. The place went up like a tinderbox on account of the old narrow streets and the heavy timbering. Lübeck's twin town of Rostock met the same fate a few weeks later. Like Lubeck, according to the official historians, Rostock was inflammable because it contained many medieval buildings, and again, like Lubeck, it was only lightly defended. In a series of four-night attacks, 60% of the city was destroyed by fire. There was so little defense of the towns that bombers flew as low as 2,000 feet. On the 30th of May, the first 1,000 bomber raid was dispatched against Cologne. Again, a giant firestorm was created which could be seen for 150 miles. A whole square mile of the city center was burnt to the ground. Throughout 1943, the destruction campaign was stepped up. Attacks were aimed at the cities of the Ruhr River area, Dusseldorf, Essen, Duisburg, and also Cologne again. With the exception of the Krupp works at Essen, these attacks were aimed directly at the center of the town because it would burn more easily. The destruction of factories, according to Air Marshal Harris, could be regarded as a bonus. In the month of July, Hamburg was bombed solidly for 4 days, the Americans by day and the British by night. Techniques had so progressed that 400 planes in 15 minutes could drop as many bombs as 1,000 planes had dropped on Cologne in an hour. To make things worse, Hamburg was in the grip of an extraordinary heat wave, which raised even night temperatures above 90 degrees. As a result, the incendiary bombs raised a giant fire typhoon, which destroyed 10 square miles of the most densely populated section of the city. More than 48,000 inhabitants were killed, three-fifths being female. But the most destructive example of this terror bombing, as the RAF historians described it, was yet to come. In February 1944, it was decided to bomb Dresden in eastern Germany, a beautiful Baroque city whose normal population of 500,000 had been swollen by hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing from the Soviet advance, now only 70 miles to the east. The city was undefended. Sir Robert Soundby, deputy commander of Bomber Command, could not believe the order to bomb when it came through. He was so disturbed by it that he queried it with the Air Ministry. His message was forwarded to Churchill in Yalta. Anxious to impress the Soviets, Churchill replied that Dresden should be bombed at the first opportunity. The RAF struck on the night of 13th of February, 1945, with a carefully prepared plan which emphasized the raising of a gigantic firestorm, such as the one which engulfed Hamburg by chance. The target area, which was the center of the city, was first marked out by indicator bombs. The first indicator was dropped on the largest hospital complex in Saxony. I said hospital complex. From a height of less than 800 feet. This was followed by a bombing attack which carpeted the area and left the city in flames. The second attack, chiefly with thermite incendiary bombs, was set for 3 hours later so that the firefighters would arrive from other cities to fight the blaze. They would themselves become victims. There was no opposition at all. No German fighter planes and no anti-aircraft guns. The city was a sitting duck. The firestorm could be seen from 200 miles away. Next day, 1,350 United States flying fortresses attacked the city in daylight, even though the flames were still burning. Accompanying fighter planes had instructions to drop to rooftop level and strafe targets of opportunity. They opened fire on the masses of people jamming the roads out of Dresden and almost anything else in sight. The riverbank, already piled with corpses, to which survivors had also fled from the flames, was a special target. A group of children from the famous Kreuzkirche Choir was strafed in the Tiergartenstrasse. British POWs who had been released from their burning camps were also machine gunned. One plane flew so low in its efforts to strafe the survivors that it collided with a wagon and exploded. That night, the British air crews, who had only had 6 hours sleep after the Dresden attack, were given instructions for another Chemnitz raid. Thus, number one group crews were informed, "Tonight your target will be Chemnitz. We are going there to attack the refugees who are gathering there, especially after last night's attack on Dresden." Number three group crews were briefed, "You are going there tonight to finish off any refugees who may have escaped from Dresden." 730,000 incendiary bombs were dropped on Chemnitz that night, but with only minor damage compared to the Dresden Holocaust. On the way back, the RAF flyers could see the flames of Dresden still ablaze. In fact, the city burned for 7 days and 8 nights, according to the diary of a British prisoner of war there. For days after the Dresden attack, the city was obscured by a pall of smoke and soot. A steady shower of wet and sooty ash descended on the surrounding countryside. British POWs at Stalag 1VB, 25 miles away, were showered with particles of smoldering flesh, clothing, and charred paper for 3 days. Relief convoys of supplies were immediately dispatched to the city from the entire province. Incredible scenes of carnage awaited them. 2 trains full of evacuee children had received direct hits. Their bodies were piled up in heaps in the station. 600 refugees sheltering in the vaulted basement of the station had been killed. 100 burnt to death by incendiary bombs and the rest suffocated by fumes. Out of Dresden's 19 major hospitals, 16 had been damaged and 3 totally destroyed. At the Vitzthum High School, which was being used as an emergency hospital, only 200 of the 500 patients had been evacuated in time. The rest had perished in their beds. At the Johannstadt Maternity Hospital, 200 people had also been killed, but they were so horribly mutilated that only 138 could be identified. For several days after the attack, the streets remained strewn with corpses. The first priority was to dig out the cellars where people had taken shelter. Some of these people were still alive, but when one cellar was opened up, the Romanian soldiers doing the digging refused to go in. Eventually, an official marched down the steps and found the bottom steps very slippery. The cellar floor was covered with an 11 or 12 inch deep liquid mixture of blood, flesh, and bone. A small high explosive bomb had penetrated 4 floors of the building and exploded in the basement. The official ordered that the basement should be covered in chlorinated lime and left to dry out. An estimated 200 people had died there. Rescue workers also found dozens of people dead in emergency water tanks that had been constructed in the main city squares. People had climbed into the water to extinguish burning clothes, but in the panic could not climb out again. All had drowned. Lindenau Platz was scattered with corpses. Hundreds of naked corpses, their clothes torn off, were sprawled around a trolley car. At Seidnitzer Platz, 200 people were sitting around, just as they had been doing on the night of the raid, but this time they were all dead. Vultures were feeding off the bodies on the riverbank. Many of the victims were so shriveled and charred that they had to be literally scraped off the asphalt and then pried apart. Many of the corpses had shriveled to less than half their normal size. These kind of remains had to be shoveled into paper sacks gathered from a nearby cement works. The task of identifying, counting, and burying victims of a Holocaust of this scale remained a daunting one. A special bureau was set up to try to keep track, but eventually only estimates of the number of dead could be made, for identification was slowing down, the burial with the consequent danger of disease. Bodies were stacked up in piles in the city streets and on the railway lines to be taken away in horse-drawn carts and buried in mass graves outside the city. But the task was so great that the police vans had to be called in from as far away as Berlin to cope. Weeks passed, and still the task was unfinished. The stench of rotting flesh filled the town. Unusually large rats were seen scurrying about amongst the ruins, their coats streaked with quicklime. Eventually, the authorities had to start cremating bodies in the streets. The area around the Altmarkt was cordoned off, and vast funeral pyres were made, using girders and bricks from wrecked buildings as a hearth. 9,000 bodies were disposed of in this way. 7 or 8 large barrels of wedding rings, mostly gold, had been taken from the bodies to assist in identification. The rings, worth nearly $1 million, were taken by the Red Army as war loot when they invaded Dresden on the 8th of May. The 300 clerks who worked in the Identification Bureau were evicted from their offices as the Soviets took over. During an interview with the Bureau director, the Soviet commander insisted that the Allied air forces could not possibly be so effective a weapon of war, refused to accept the director's estimate of 335,000 dead, and calmly struck off the first digit. The raid on Dresden has gone down in our history books as the deadliest ever bombing raid. Dear Christians, remember this the next time some Jew cries on your shoulder about the phony Jew Holocaust. Remind this child of Satan about his people murdering innocent babies in Dresden on a Christian holiday.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message, and that you were fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.